This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coronavirus. What can you do? And how can this nightmare end? Popular UK nurse, teacher, Dr. John Campbell's tips. I'm Alex Smith. Here we go. Dr. John Campbell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, no doubt we're going to talk about many countries, but I'd like to start with your own. In the middle of March, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson suggested COVID-19 was not all that serious. The government would let the disease burn through the population until some sort of herd immunity was reached, he suggested. Well, of course, hundreds of scientists and medical professionals objected, and that deadly idea barely lasted a weekend. But as in the United States, valuable time has been lost as the leadership doesn't seem to get the population to self-isolate in time. So now, what was the situation in the UK by the end of March?
Yeah, you raise an absolutely vital point, Alec. I mean, throughout this, governments have been reactive rather than proactive. Now, that particular statement by the Prime Minister was based on medical advice at the time. And I think this just shows the way that even amongst senior medical officers, understanding of this virus has been evolving. And what actually happened in that case in particular was the chief scientific officer and the chief medical officer gave advice to the Prime Minister, which he then followed. But then other modellers, particularly Imperial College London, who specialise in a lot of epidemiological modelling, said that if this model was followed, there would be just a horrendous peak and an appalling number of cases. Because what seems to be happening globally from data in China, from data from Italy, it seems that of every 100 people that get the COVID-19 infection that have been diagnosed, around about 12 of those are going to need some form of treatment because they can be quite severely ill. And of those, about 5% can be critical. So if the government had carried on following that program, what would have happened is, you're right in saying that herd immunity would have developed fairly quickly, but millions of people would have got infected, and millions of people would be infected all at the same time. And if you want to work out what those percentages are, if it was 10 million people who were infected all at the same time, and 12% were very poorly and 5% were critically ill, then you can see from that no health service in the world could possibly look after that number of people. So that sort of thinking evolved fairly quickly. But it is a pity that governments have been reacting to things rather than being proactive, because this gives the virus time to go from individual cases to clusters to community spread. And very often, by the time dramatic shutdown measures like we're now seeing with about a quarter of the world's population, by the time that happens, very often there's established community spread. And that makes it all the more difficult to get the number of cases down again.
Yes, even after more than a week of pretty complete lockdown, there were shocking high death counts in Italy. Did the lockdown fail?
No, that's an excellent question. The incubation period for this disease is typically 5, 6, or 7 days, and we say 2 to 14 days. So if there was a lot of community transmission just before the start of a lockdown, then that means there's a backlog of cases which are incubating through the start of the lockdown. So the lockdown started, but cases still keep rising because the incubation period is resulting in more people, as it were, coming out the end of this pipeline that are becoming infected. And as well as that, deaths tend to occur in the second, third, fourth, or even fifth week after the onset of symptoms. So cases can carry on rising and deaths can carry on rising for some time after the lockdown. But this virus will only survive in the respiratory tract of human beings. It's the only place it can reproduce. And if we stop it spreading from one respiratory tract to another, the virus ends with that person when one person develops immunity. We can break these chains of transmission. And this top-down approach, this community shutdown, this social physical distancing is one way to do that. Now, I think in Italy, for the past 4 days now, we're talking about the end, towards the end of March now, the past 4 days, there's been a decrease in the percentage increase of new cases in Italy. Now, that means the total number is still increasing, of course, but the rate of increasing is now slowing down. And with the lockdown continuing, we would expect that to go down to no new cases, and then we would expect the number of cases to start falling off, perhaps about 3 weeks into the lockdown. So lockdown is a strategy where we have to be patient and wait for the benefits to come out. But they will come out. I believe strongly they will come out. So I believe strongly that the number of cases in Italy and Spain will start to drop in the next week or two. And in my country, where the lockdown has just started, I believe the number of cases will start to drop in about 2 weeks' time. And I believe it's essential that we do this. Otherwise, we're going to have a glut of very ill people all at the same time. And we will not be able to cope with that.
Well, as you know, this situation is very hard to predict because there are doubling times every 2 days in some countries in the number of cases and deaths a few weeks after that. But given we're speaking at the end of March, what is your prognosis for the situation in New York City?
The lockdown in New York is now becoming more and more effective. So if that lockdown is obeyed by the majority of people, that will break the chain of transmission. But this is going to be expensive in terms of economy and in terms of lifestyle. So what happens in New York City depends on the people of New York City. If they obey this lockdown and they do not socialize, they do not go to their friend's house for a drink, they do not go out for meals, they do not invite their friends around for a game of cards, they do always maintain a 2 meter distance, especially in indoor environments. They do maintain good personal hygiene. They are careful to wash their hands when they come in. If they obey all of these things, then given that this strategy has recently started, I would expect the cases to carry on increasing for the next week or two. But if this is obeyed, then I would expect the number of cases, as appears to be happening in Italy, to start to go down now. But if this is not obeyed, if people carry on interacting as they have been in the past, then the number of cases will carry on increasing, and the number of critical cases will also carry on increasing. Now, even where we are, specifically in New York situation, at the moment there's 3,000 critical care beds available in New York City. It's estimated that in about 2 to 3 weeks' time, that when this current wave of the outbreak will probably peak, given the shutdown measures we've seen in New York, they're going to need 30,000 critical care beds to look after this 5% of the population that's going to be in critical need. And it's really quite hard to see about how that is happening. So if that doesn't happen, what that will mean is the case fatality rate, the percentage of people that die per 100 of people that are infected, is tragically going to increase. So it very much depends on the behavior of everyone. Everyone has to realize that everyone has a role to play in this. And if they start socializing with their friends, that could essentially be condemning someone else to death. We really must socially isolate, meticulous hygiene, and we need to flatten this curve. We need to stop the increase in the rate of growth. But we won't see the benefits of that for about 2 weeks. It has to work through the incubation period.
We have seen videos from weeping doctors in Italy and in Spain saying that they had to do a triage to make a decision, and basically no one over the age of 65 would get a ventilator until they could get more ventilators. And I don't know whether those have been, you know, whether those are credible reports, but it sounds possible that many major cities may come to that point if we can't get a grip on this.
Yes. This is not something that's unknown to intensive care medicine anyway. Before someone goes into intensive care, they're usually assessed in some detail by one or two senior doctors, very often an intensivist and an anaesthetist. And they decide if this person can benefit from intensive care, because not everyone benefits from intensive care. It's a very high-risk procedure anyway. If you or me, as healthy people at the moment, walk into an intensive care unit and we were ventilated for a week or two, then our chances of dying from that wouldn't be insignificant, and that's walking in healthy. So intensive care is actually quite a high-risk procedure, so it's always necessary to be careful about who it's appropriate to give intensive care to. But the situation in Italy, while they are doing that to a large extent, they are prioritising those that will benefit from patient care. The sheer weight of numbers has meant, and these reports are credible, and I have heard them from other sources, that doctors are having to essentially decide who gets ventilated or not when two patients would both potentially benefit from intensive care. And what they seem to be doing, from anecdotal reports, I haven't got any definitive evidence on this, but it does make perfect sense that they're saying people over the age of 65 have to give way to people under the age of 65 for prioritisation for ventilators. This is just a completely heart-wrenching decision for any clinician. And the other tragedy in that situation is because the people in the intensive care unit and the very poor people are infected, their relatives can't go in to be with them. So we have this tragic situation where people are denied the intensive medical care that could potentially save their lives, not necessarily, but potentially. And then they can't have their loved ones around them when they die. So that just upsets the whole dying process. It upsets the whole grieving process for the relatives as well. And it's just an appalling situation, but it's one which resources allow no alternative but to make at the moment. It's an appalling situation. And it just shows the importance of preventing the community spread, so we prevent too many people all being ill at the same time.
John Campbell, do you have any insight into why the reported deaths in Germany are so much lower than in neighboring European countries, even though they have thousands and thousands of cases?
Yes, it's an excellent question. The German health authorities have very good health facilities throughout Germany, and they have quite a lot of critical care facility. So for the number of cases that they've had in Germany, up until very recently, they have been able to provide quite a lot of health care for these people. And if you can provide good health care, you can reduce the case fatality rate. And I think the other factor in Germany is Germany have been relatively reactive in terms of social shutdown. They haven't had as much social shutdown as I would like to have been. But what they've been more proactive with in Germany is the testing, and there's been quite a lot of testing. Now, if you can only test a small amount of your population, so for example, if 10 people die and you've tested 100 people to diagnose 100 people, that will give you a death rate of 10%. Because 10% of the people that have been tested positive die. But if you can test a lot more people, as you have done in Germany, so if you can test 1,000 people and you still find 10 of those die, then that brings your death rate down to 0.1%. So the more people you test, and we know that most people actually get a fairly mild form of this disease, so the more people you test, the more people you diagnose, the relatively smaller the case fatality rate in terms of percentages. So I think they're the two main factors in Germany. And there's cause for hope there as well, because when we get more testing, it may well be that in my country, for example, there could have been tens of thousands of people who are infected already. We simply don't know. And if that's the case, so we think there's maybe about 10,000 people infected now, but if it turns out there's been 100,000 people infected, then that would make the case fatality rate 100 times lower, which would be remarkably good news. So I think they're the two factors that are giving the impression that the death rate is lower in Germany. But I think the actual virulence of the disease and the nature of the virus is basically the same in Germany. And as well as that, I would expect the death rate in Germany to carry on rising, unfortunately, as well.
From what we've seen so far, John, do you think it's realistic to expect a pause in this disease in the Northern Hemisphere during this summer?
This disease does not seem to have a great degree of seasonality. And the reason I believe that is because it seems to be spreading in hotter countries. So southern China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, and now, unfortunately, places like South Africa seem to have community spread. And indeed, quite a few places in Africa seem to have community spread. And of course, these countries are much warmer than the Northern Hemisphere is, even at the height of summer. So I don't think we're going to get a seasonality effect like we get with influenza. What will reduce the spread, though, in the Northern Hemisphere as the weather gets warmer is people do not spend so much time with the windows shut indoors, so they're not as close together in as close proximity, and they spend more time in the fresh air. So that might reduce the spread somewhat. But what I think is going to happen is the shutdown measures that have been implemented now all over Northern Europe are going to start to be effective in the next few weeks, and we will see a reduction in cases. Now, if these measures had not been implemented, then I think over the next year, about 50, 60, who knows, maybe 70% of the population of Northern Europe and North America would have been infected with this virus. So these lockdown measures are absolutely essential. But they're very difficult to carry on for economic and social reasons. We can't really carry on these lockdown measures until we get a vaccine, which might be perhaps in the summer of 2021. So what we need to do is attack this disease from underneath as well with massively increased testing. And then we have massively increased testing. We can just, as I already said, isolate the people that are infected. And that can allow most people to go back to work. And the other thing about the increased testing is that we're bringing out, I know my government's ordered 3.5 million of these to start with, where we actually test for the antibody. And the antibody is the test for the immune protein that the body makes in response to the virus. And someone will have that when they've recovered, perhaps for a year or 2 years, or perhaps for decades, or maybe even for life, we don't know yet, after they've had the virus. But that means if someone has got that antibody, it means they've had the virus, and then it's very likely, in fact, we believe strongly that that person would then be immune to the virus and then could go back to normal duties without the risk of infecting other people.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Scientists in China reported live COVID-19 virus was found in fecal matter, so we need to be careful how we clean and dispose of that. But the burning question for me is, can this virus be transmitted in the air? What do we know so far?
Two good points. There's no question that the virus has been cultured and can be transmitted from feces. And there's evidence that when a toilet is flushed, there can be an aerosolization effect of the virus from the feces if the lid of the toilet is not put down. And there's also been, the virus has also been isolated from sewage. So that is certainly the case. Now, the question about the aerosolization of the virus is one that is still an ongoing debate. First of all, let's say what we know for sure. What we know for sure is this is a droplet infection. The virus is shed from the respiratory lining of people's respiratory tracts that are infected. It gets into their mucus and then they cough it up. And that virus goes out of the body in droplets. And those droplets can either go into someone else's eyes, nose, or mouth infection, or those droplets can fall down with gravity onto a surface, which an uninfected person then touches with their hands and transmits the virus from their hands into their face, into their mucous membranes. That's why hand hygiene is so critical in this, and social distancing is so critical. Now, the difference between a droplet infection and an aerosolized infection is the size of the water particles in which the virus can live. So when someone sneezes, for example, there's a vast range in size of the droplets that are sneezed out, from really quite microscopic to what you can actually see if you were sneezed onto your computer screen, for example. So there's a big range. And there's not like a strict cutoff between an infection that is droplet infection and an infection that is aerosol infection. And it seems to me, from cumulative data that we've got, that this is somewhere between. So for example, on the Diamond Princess, it looks like this was the cruise ship that was in Yokohama and quarantined. And well over 700 people got infected on that ship. And it looks like many of those got infected through the air conditioning, because a lot of the inside cabins have no windows, so the people were dependent on circulated air from the ship to be able to have fresh air in their cabins. So it looks like there was aerosolization spread there with smaller droplets. And also there's some evidence that there's been aerosolization spread in air conditioner units where you get these smaller droplets potentially going from office to office. Now, there's still ongoing debate about this, but I think what we can be fairly clear about is it's not going to be spread dramatically in the open air. So it's not going to blow in the wind from village to village or from house to house. But in enclosed environments, some people are believing that the virus can be suspended in the air for 3 hours in closed, poorly ventilated environments. Now, even if the final data transpires to show that's only for 3 or 4 minutes, that would indicate some aerosolization has spread and shows how critically important it is not to be too close to people, especially in poorly ventilated areas. So it seems to be between the standard droplet infection and the aerosolized infection. Quite where it is on that continuum, we don't really know yet.
Suppose the hospitals are overwhelmed. They can't take any more patients, or it just seems too dangerous to go there, and we have a very sick person at home. What would a seasoned nurse do to give that person the best chances of survival at home?
It's remarkably difficult to give proper medical care at home. Now, for the vast majority of people, it's just going to be a matter of lying around, feeling awfully ill for a few days, and then getting better. Now, one of the risk factors in this disease is pneumonia. And in nursing, we've always known that people with pneumonia and potential chest infection should be nursed sitting up. So having these patients lie down, especially lying on their back, would be a bad idea. So if possible, we want people to sit up. And we want to encourage coughing and expectoration to get as much sputum out as possible. To get as much oxygen into the body, if we don't have any oxygen supply, then there's going to be higher concentrations of oxygen in fresh air outside of the house than there is inside the house. So we could sit them up near an open window as long as it wasn't too cold for them. And also, we want the mucus in their lungs to remain as mobile as possible. What we don't want is for the mucus to dry out. So if the person becomes dehydrated, again, it would be harder for them to clear the mucus, making pneumonia and these other severe complications more likely. So drinking plenty of fluids would be a good idea. And the other thing that is sometimes of benefit that we also do in critical care situations, for example, is for an hour or two at a time we'll nurse patients prone, which basically means lying on their tummy as opposed to lying on their back. So it may be, we don't really know, but it may be that some time lying on the tummy alternating with time sitting up would be a good idea. And that brings us on to another debate. The whole nature of a fever, to me, the reason the body generates a fever is there's quite specific physiological mechanisms that generate a fever. A fever is not some accident. It's the body deliberately increasing the body temperature to reduce the ability of the viruses to reproduce and also to optimize the functioning of the body's own immune system. So when you take a drug like acetaminophen, Tylenol, or as we call it in this country, paracetamol, that's going to reduce the fever. Now, that will make you feel an awful lot better because the fever makes you feel sick. But again, in my view, that's going to reduce the efficiency of the immune system. So if I was in a situation where I couldn't access medical care, personally, I would not take fever reducers. I would feel awful, but I would leave my fever as it was. I think people need to think twice about reducing fever as readily as we do, because fever is a natural part of the body's defense mechanisms. But they're going to have to make their own decisions on that and ideally talk to their own doctors. But that's what I do for me personally, but I can't prescribe for your viewers. Apart from that, there's very little that you can do at home on your own. Maintain good nutrition. When you're acutely ill, if you feel hungry, eat. If you don't feel hungry, don't force yourself to eat. But just make sure you take in plenty of fluids. And if you do feel you're deteriorating and then you're really not being able to breathe effectively, then you really do need to take external medical advice about that.
We all want to know how this nightmare could possibly end. I can think of several ways that we talked about getting a vaccine within a year and a half, even 2 years. We don't know. Or the earlier idea of it will just rush through the population and the survivors will have immunity. How can this end, John?
In a civilized society, I don't think we can possibly say we just have to let this go. We're going to accept 5% people being critically ill who might not get treatment. That's just not an acceptable option. We have to carry on with the lockdown measures, and we absolutely have to massively increase testing. Now, when we do that, we can control the epidemic. And you're right, more and more people will get the infection. Most people will have a mild illness, and the herd immunity will increase. And if we have the testing, we will know who has immunity and who doesn't, so we can moderate our behavior accordingly. So instead of these blanket lockdowns, we can have much more targeted lockdown of the population. And that means that everything can carry on much more normally than it would if we had this blanket lockdown. So I would see the future as being carrying on with the lockdown until we can massively increase testing, then have the strategy of selective lockdown and massive testing for the rest of this year. But this pandemic is only going to go away when there's no more people left for it to infect. That's the only time it's actually going to finish. And the only times there's going to be no more people left for it to infect is if people have immunity. And there's only two ways people can get immunity. That is by having the disease themselves or by being vaccinated. So unfortunately, I do not believe the world is going to be rid of this pandemic until we have an effective vaccine for it, and that may well be summer 2021. Now, even if that happens for summer 2021, that is going to be far and away the quickest vaccine that has ever been developed in the history of humanity and would represent a major triumph for medical science. But I believe that is attainable. Until then, we have to carry on with the lockdown strategies, increasing testing, and then selective isolation and quarantine for those that are testing positive, with greater freedom for those that have the antibody that we know are now immune to the disease. That's the only way it can end, when there are no more people it can infect.
Yes, I suppose once we have tests that really show who has immunity, then they could go back to work at critical jobs and try and keep things running until we get the vaccine on board. Now, John Campbell, you and I are prime targets for the worst of this disease. We are men over the age of 65. What measures are you taking to protect you and yours?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm 62 at the moment. So in the 60 to 70-year-old age group, the probability of death in China when you caught that infection was 3.6%. Now, I'm actually retired from professional healthcare at the moment, but pretty soon I'm going to have to decide whether I go back and do some work as a staff nurse on A&E. It may be that I decide my work as an academic is actually worth carrying on, and I'll carry on with the videos and do that from home. But what I'm doing at the moment is the same as everyone else. So in the UK now, we are totally locked down. We are not going to our friends' houses. Our friends are not coming here. Only myself and my wife are in the house, so we go for walks once a day together. We're allowed out once a day for a walk. If we do walk and we meet friends, we make sure we keep 2 meters apart from them. I am not going to see my parents. I am not going to see my children. I'm not going to see my grandson. We have to be socially isolated from absolutely everyone. Whenever we've been out, we have to practice meticulous hygiene, so I take my shoes off when I come in the house, and I wash my hands properly and clinically when I come in. And I dry them on a kitchen roll and throw that away. If I'm outside, I'm very careful not to cough or sneeze at anyone. Fortunately, I don't have a cold or anything at the moment, so that's not particularly a problem. But I'm careful I don't go within 2 meters of anyone, so I'm not even breathing on them. So these are all the common sense measures that we can take. Basically, you don't go out of the house or the garden or wherever you live unless you've got a good reason to do so. So it's only essential food shopping, going to care for vulnerable people, or going out for exercise once a day. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to separate the idea here of social isolation from physical isolation. So we have to be physically isolated but socially close. So we need to keep talking to people. Think about your area. Think about people that might be isolated and call them up, talk to them on the internet, or you could even shout at them through a glass window. That would be absolutely fine as long as there's a physical separation. But just making sure that people don't feel alone, even when they're physically isolated. Other than that, we're just waiting for testing coming on board, which is going to be the next way we're going to attack this pandemic while we wait for the vaccine.
As we wrap up here, John, do you have any closing message for our listeners?
We need to carry on social isolation. We have to obey what the authorities are telling us to do. We must not work out ways to flout the rules. We have to go with this. This is something we have to do all together. We have to move forward collectively. Me being silly, me going out to meet some friends or going around to a friend's house or something like that could result in some other more vulnerable person or potentially even me dying from this condition. There are no higher stakes here. We have to cooperate with this. And we have to wait for the testing and we have to wait for the vaccine. But we have to realize that everyone has a role to play and we have to comply with this. It's difficult in the short term. But the better we do it, the shorter time we'll have to do it for. So let's all comply with this, go together and beat this virus. And we will beat it. This pandemic will go with the shutdown, with the testing, and finally with the vaccination. We'll be over and we're going to bounce back. And let's hope we both bounce back into a wiser, more civilized, more learned form of humanity.
From Britain, we have been speaking with nurse trainer and now online teacher to the world, Dr. John Campbell. Thank you, John, for your help in this urgent hour.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you for having me again. Very kind of you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.